It's time for Twink This Week at Google Great Panel. Mike Elgin joins Jeff Jarvis and me. We'll talk about the FCC's proposal to use Title II. Victory or not? We'll also find out what Google's up to with some of its more oddball projects. And I've got a tip for people who want to learn to do a little programming. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 286, recorded February 4th, 2015.
Shake me harder.
This Week in Google is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting snacks right to your door. Start snacking smarter with wholesome, delicious treats like roasted Peruvian corn kernels. Man! To get your complimentary NatureBox sampler, visit naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom's not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code TWIG to receive $10 off at checkout. And by Lynda.com. Invest in yourself for 2015. Lynda.com has thousands of courses to help you learn new tech, business, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit Lynda.com/twig. That's Lynda.com/twig. This is Twig, This Week in Google, the show where we talk about Google, the cloud, the cloudiverse. When is Gina coming back for an episode? Is it next month, next week, next hour?
Let me take a look at the schedule. I believe it is next week.
Hey.
Yay!
Hey, Jeff and I miss Gina. But don't worry. We've got great people in her place. Jeff Jarvis is here, professor of journalism at the City University of New York. He's got his Chromebook Pixel. He's padding it because we've compelled him to use an unnamed computer for his Skype.
Liberal commie computer.
But boy, doesn't that look good?
Oh, rub it in.
That's okay. It's okay. Just think of this as a dedicated video conferencing device, not a computer. And you never have to use this.
Look, our TriCaster runs on a Windows machine.
Yeah.
But you'd never know it.
You'd
because
never know
it's
it.
A TriCaster.
Exactly.
Ooh.
We're running Windows 7.
Cooties.
Yeah, exactly. Jeff computer is the author cooties. Of Public Parts, What Would Google Do? Gutenberg the Geek. And his latest, Geek Sparing Gifts, Reimagining News in the Modern World.
Ain't that exciting.
Ain't that the greatest. BuzzMachine.com is his blog. Look who's here. Mike Elgin, our news director from TNT. Mike is the most popular man on Google Plus, practically.
That's yep. Me and Lady Gaga. We're the
you
most
and Lady Gaga.
Popular men.
Also a writer at Computer World and other magazines. He's an expert in the cloud and in Google, and we should get you on more. I just don't want to overburden you because you have to do TNT every Monday through Friday.
This show is like a vacation, a tropical island.
It's dessert.
I love this show. It is dessert.
Yeah.
And boy, is it going to be
we got whipped cream and cherries
meal.
On this.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's start with the FCC. Tom Wheeler in a editorial published on Wired, clearly reaching out to us.
Yes.
To the geeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Saying, it's interesting. Dan Gilmore wrote an article apologizing to Tom Wheeler for mischaracterizing him as a shill. I guess.
That's very Dan. That's a very neat thing to do.
Yeah. I guess Oliver was going to have to say, I'm sorry for calling you. What do you call him? A dingo?
Yeah.
John Oliver is going to have, he's off the air right now. He's in hiatus. But when he comes back, he's going to have to say, I'm sorry I called you a dingo.
Well, the devil is in the details. Let's see the full language. But so far, so good.
Well, now I'm scared. We got what we wanted. Tom Wheeler has agreed to use Title II of the Telecommunications Act of 1934 while tailoring it for the 21st century in order to create a competitive network in order to prevent fast lane prioritization. And, it's actually interesting. He refers to, and I had forgotten this, a startup that he did in the 80s called Naboo.
This is the most fascinating part to me, is that what happened is that he tried to do high speed back in the day, but it required working with cable companies, and cable companies effed him, and it came home to roost.
And AOL beat him. He said, we were delivering 1.5 megabits per second back in the 80s. That was amazing. Steve Case was dial-up. Wheeler says, Case told me at the time, we used to worry a lot about Naboo. But Naboo went broke while AOL became obviously very successful. Wheeler writes, why that is highlights the fundamental problem with allowing networks to act as gatekeepers. While delivering better service, Naboo had to depend on cable television operators granting access to their system. Steve Case of AOL was not only a brilliant entrepreneur, but he had access to an unlimited number of customers nationwide who only had to attach a modem to their phone line. The phone network was open.
Because the FCC made it open.
Cable networks were closed. End of story. For Tom Wheeler to say that kind of, to me, gives him a lot of street cred. Because he's right.
Well, you know what? He's like a sleeper cell for the EFF. You know, it's kind of great, right? We thought that he was going to be a sellout because he'd worked in the industry and all that. But this experience from early in his career, the permissionless development, the ability to reach people on an open network, he got it in his soul and it came back. And God bless him. Let's just hope it stays this way. And the phone companies, you know, and the cable companies, you screwed yourselves, guys. You know, you put yourself, you could have been nice. You could have had a sign up that says, don't be evil. You could have had a sign up that said, just because we can doesn't mean we should. You could have had a sign up that said, let's not treat our customers like prisoners. But you didn't. And so it's all come home to roost on the big old companies, and they're all going to sue the FCC.
AT&T has already said it is.
Oh, yeah.
They say, if they do this, we're suing. We're in. Here's an interesting thing. He's actually gone farther than some people, including Google, wanted him to go. He says, using the authority of Title II, I am submitting to my colleagues, the other commissioners of the FCC, the strongest open internet protections ever proposed by the FCC. These enforceable bright line rules will ban paid prioritization, fast lanes, and the blocking and throttling of lawful content and services. But here's where he's going.
Come here.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I propose to fully apply for the first time ever those bright line rules to mobile broadband.
And that's a huge deal. Huge deal.
Huge.
Even Google acknowledged in its amicus filing with Verizon that broadband should be treated differently on mobile.
Right.
In Google's devil's deal with Verizon. I've never been more ashamed of Google.
I remember that.
But at that moment, and I screamed about it in the show, it was a moment of prostitution to try to make nice to phone companies. It was never going to yield anything, but Google said, we'll apply net neutrality to wired line, not to mobile. And it was wrong. It was evil. And God bless, Tom Wheeler is less evil than Google right now.
Two things to look out for. One of them is coming up to your punchline of them embracing mobile was the fact that it says that, you know, any sort of legal content. Yeah. So that is determined by lawmakers.
Yeah.
And the lawmakers are going to be the fly in the ointment here. It's Congress, and a minority of Republicans in Congress are going to want to attack and destroy this. And, of course, the lobbyists, Wheeler's former colleagues, are going to be attacking Congress in all this. And so that's risky. Secondly, Wheeler said specifically that what I have giveth the future FCC chairman can taketh away in a couple of years. Right. And so that makes me nervous. The precedent is huge, though. It gives it a lot of weight and gives us a good shot of having net neutrality going forward. But you have to realize that if we didn't get net neutrality right now, we would never get it. Yep. And most countries are leaning toward no net neutrality because, once again, as is, you know, the case in the United States and everywhere, the companies, there's so much money to be made in screwing the consumer and providing.
Well, Europe, to its regulatory credit, is going for net neutrality all around. I saw Oettinger, the new digital head in Europe, and I'm scared with what his lobby's going to do. I think he's going to do a European-wide, get ready for it, Leistungsschutzrecht. But they sing the song of net neutrality in Europe. I think that we were behind on that. and this might put us back to where we ought to be.
I got the feeling that they started to go strong with net neutrality early in last year, in spring of last year. And then by the end of the year, they were saying, you know, on second thought, maybe we ought to just kind of tinker with it a little bit. And
well, that's the risk. Always.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's problematic. But I mean, it remains to be seen, I think. The biggest thing is that people can't relax now. Everybody who wrote letters.
No, right to your member of Congress.
Exactly, yeah. Because now is when we win it or Amen. Lose it.
Now, he did do, first when I read the headline, I went, gulp, because we got what we wanted. But now I'm nervous about what the other side has said all along, which is you don't want the federal government, especially the FCC, regulating the internet, because there's all sorts of stuff in Title II this gives them power to do. He was very clear that he intends to honor President Obama's notion of forbearance, not enforcing everything. He says he wants to create incentive for broadband operators to invest. So he's going to modernize Title II. For instance, no rate regulation. This was something everybody was a little worried about.
That's critical for them.
No tariffs. No last mile unbundling. What's that?
Well, that's in Britain. I think this is what it means. Tell me if I'm wrong, chat room. But in Britain, BT puts the fiber or puts the cable into your house, but it's like your power line.
Others yeah, why can, wouldn't can we want it. Last mile unbundling?
I think we would, but I think that's a big sop to the cable companies. And
he's saying if you spent the money, the capital investment to get the last mile, you're going to continue to own that last mile. And that is true that may, and the FCC decided this the last time this came up more than a decade ago, They gave a monopoly to the cable companies in every region, saying, look, you're going to invest a lot of money in infrastructure. You need to be able to monetize. That was what they saw as necessary to incent right. investment. He said,
but
over the last 21 years, the wireless industry has invested almost $300 billion under similar rules, proving that modernized Title II regulation can encourage investment and competition. I have to say, last mile unbundling has happened on phone companies, AT&T and others have to unbundle, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I'm not convinced that that's...
What do you mean? What do you mean?
They...
MVNOs?
No. That's they well, not in mobile, but in landline, in DSL, it's unbundled. The last mile has been put in by AT&T or Verizon, yeah. But you can get it from SonicNet or DSL Extreme or some other provider.
Right, which is not the case here.
But I would like to see that on cable.
Yep. Yeah.
The other important decision, which was a few days ago, which is the administration saying that they're going to fight the limitations on towns overbuilding and competing with cable companies.
Municipal internet is the right answer to all of this, I think. Well, so this all sounds very good. In fact, the EFF writing today said, today we are celebrating. Chairman Wheeler's announcement signals the FCC is at long last making real progress on net neutrality. But they do agree the battle is not over. We need to ensure the FCC rules will actually do what is needed to protect the open internet and no more. And I think that, Mike, you're absolutely right. This is now it's time to write your Congress critter and say, you know, good. Now let's promote competition. Let's promote investment. I don't think unbundling the last mile is a bad idea.
Here's the thing. I think that this is going to be made, if it hasn't already been made, into a left-right issue with people on the right being told that this is a government regulation thing.
Right.
And there is a government regulation thing to a certain extent. And so those reflexes are being exercised. And this is not the issue to exercise those reflexes, in my opinion, because the alternative to so-called government regulation, where there's a level playing field essentially, and where there, you know, that all traffic has to be treated equally, is that Comcast is in charge of determining these things, and Comcast has demonstrated that it just will screw customers over for a buck at every chance it gets.
I agree, Mike. That's what I was saying before too. I think that the telecommunications industry could have avoided this.
Yeah.
They could have shown that they weren't evil. I mean, there really is an attitude is if we can, we will. We'll charge you for every little thing. We're going to screw you over. We're going to treat you like prisoners. It's a business. It's a prisoner business model, like an airline prisoner business model. And they brought it upon themselves. No one trusts them. No one trusts them. They have to buy their friends in Congress. And that's what will come, you know, to bear now. And we'll see what the power of that lobbying is. But Wheeler clearly heard the country speak and heard Silicon Valley speak. and then listened.
AT&T warned that Title II is far from bulletproof. They didn't pull any punches. Hank Hultquist, writing on the AT&T public policy blog, said, "Today we made a couple of filings at the FCC disputing its authority to reclassify ISPs as common carriers." He says, "This decision is driven by political considerations. We think they're going to do it, but we ought to warn them we're going to court, and we don't think it's sustainable. We think court will overturn it, just as Verizon won in court with the FCC's open internet regulations." I have to point out, though, that that court told Verizon, or told the FCC, if you were to pursue Title II,
right,
we might be able to support you on this.
That's why they went against.
Yeah.
That's why they went against them, because Title II was not the law of the land.
Yeah. They're quoting Justice Scalia's dissenting opinion in a Supreme Court decision. Brand X. Of course, a dissent has no weight in law at all, but they, I think, hold out hope that maybe Justice Scalia will support them if it goes to the Supreme Court.
I'm not worried about AT&T's lawsuit. I'm worried about AT&T's by the Congress budget. They give more to campaign contributions and other financing than the other company.
Well, here's their argument. So this doesn't sound completely wrong to me. And again, they're quoting Justice Scalia. He said ISPs are not merely an information service. They're a transmission service. He compared them to pizzerias that offer both a combination of pizza and home delivery, or a pet store that sells dogs but includes the leash.
I'm getting a headache.
Scalia is notorious for this. We disagree with Scalia's view that ISPs simultaneously offer both information and telecommunications service, says AT&T. The FCC has long adhered to an interpretation of the statute under which these definitions are mutually exclusive. You can't be both a telecommunications service, a transport, and an information service.
I don't understand that analogy. In what way does your average ISP, obviously the Comcast and so on are serving up both content and bandwidth. Is that what they're talking about? I mean, they shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't get your puppy from the same place you get the leash or whatever. We want dumb pipes. The dumber, the better.
Right.
And the bigger, the better. That's what we want. And that's what we need in order to compete with the rest of the world economically. That's what we need in order to retain our status as an economic superpower. You know, we need these things. We can't be nickeled and dimed to death by...
Right. So, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Dumb pipes are a commodity, and they know that, and the value will come in the unique content, and we're going to buy that from Netflix, not from Comcast. And that's exactly what they're afraid of. They know it. They know this is happening. They know it's inevitable now. This is not a big surprise to them. They're just trying to fight to the last rather than saying, this is where the world's going. Why don't we start our own damn Netflix and compete like crazy on the basis of quality?
I have to think this public policy blog is aimed at congressional staffers and if they understood it, members of Congress. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially laying out the argument.
This is what we paid you to say. Here it is.
Yes, exactly.
This is what you should be saying now. So not only are we talking a lawsuit, we're talking severe lobbying along these lines. We'll see. Tom Wheeler, I apologize. You're not a dingo or a shill for the telecommunications and cable companies. You are a free man. and you did the right thing, I think, so far.
Yeah.
And I think did it in a very nuanced way that protects a little bit the people. You know, we did a great debate on Twit a few, maybe a couple months ago, with two internet service providers on different sides of this. And I think that he's saying the things here that will reassure the ISP from Larry at Wyoming, who was very concerned about getting a heavy-handed government regulations in his business while protecting the internet. So it seems like he's done a good job on this. Let's hope so. You wrote a good article, Mike, on Computer World.
Thank you.
Seven smartphone rules that changed this week. That kind of ties along. This was before the FCC
It was. It was. But the FCC lately has been, well, the month of January, changed everything for smartphone users. The very
really
pro
great.
User.
Yeah,
exactly. So just quickly going through these, the carriers, if you recall, the FTC actually and the FCC are both working together. But basically, the FTC said that the TracFone, they basically ordered the prepaid mobile provider TracFone to pay a fine of $40 million because they throttled an unlimited data plan.
Wow.
So essentially that established the rule. These aren't laws. These are just rules, basically, but everybody has to adhere to these precedents where you can sell unlimited data plans and you can throttle data, but they can't be the same plan.
The FTC was clear to say this is not a rule against throttling. This is a false advertising
exactly.
ruling. You can't say unlimited in an advertisement and then throttle.
Exactly.
And actually, I think that's a little controversial because unlimited means as many bits as you want. Throttling just means we're going to give them to you slower.
Right. But taken to an extreme, you can imagine, oh, give you 1 megabyte, and after that, it's right. The speed of a 300 baud modem.
Yeah,
but it's unlimited.
Is clear.
Yeah, yeah.
The intention is clear.
Yeah.
But here's, Mike, the eighth rule that's not there is that hotels can't sell high speed when it ain't high speed.
Yes.
They should be held to account for what they sell.
Right.
And this was the second change that they made, which was the FCC declared that true broadband, they upgraded it. Used to be 4 megabits down, 1 megabit up. Now it's 25 megabits down, 3 megabits up. What does that change, this new definition of broadband?
It changes the idea that they're going to be selling a 4 megabit per second connection as
broadband.
Yeah. Everybody uses broadband now to be synonymous with just internet connectivity. We do it all the time, and we journalists do it all the time. Just call it mobile broadband, for example. Well, you know, there's a lot of data connectivity that's super, super, super slow, and we're calling broadband. Broadband used to be a distinction to separate fast internet connectivity with slow internet connectivity. And it's still, I mean, 25 megabits per second, I don't think, for downloads, I don't think is that fast. It's a pretty low hurdle.
The standards have changed over the years.
Well,
I would have been thrilled with a megabit and a half 15 years ago.
One of the co-anchors on Tech News Today is Elise Hugh. She's moving to Seoul, Korea, and she's going to become the Seoul bureau chief for NPR. And she was saying that they essentially define broadband as 100 megabits per second.
Right.
And everybody's got it. I mean,
But isn't it the government providing it? Is it private industry or is it a government-run
system? I think the government is squeezing
They've
the carriers.
Perhaps.
Something like that. But
that's the issue. I mean, we hear a lot about Sweden and South Korea and other countries where they have very inexpensive, very high-speed internet.
Yeah.
But in almost every case, it's subsidized.
Yeah, and I don't see anything wrong with that.
No, I don't either.
I'm not a big, government should be, taxing and spending. But I saw a study, I think it was last year at some point, somebody calculated how much it would cost to give everybody in the United States Google Fiber level speed.
How much?
It was like a couple $100 billion. It was basically what we spent in Afghanistan in 2 weeks.
Apple should
or
do
something.
It,
you
right.
know, it's yeah, exactly.
So I think it does have an unintended consequence because by redefining broadband, you suddenly make Comcast 56% of all the broadband market. They have more than half of all U.S. broadband customers.
Good point.
Yep.
And that's actually Ars Technica made that point, but a great point. And I don't know if that was an intended consequence or not, but now Congress has to grapple, or not the Congress, I guess. Is it the FTC who has to rule on the Comcast Time Warner merger?
It's an antitrust.
Whoever's regulating that has to really now say, oh, well, you really do have a lion's share.
Well, you know, I think what's happening here is, in general, I think we're finally getting the president we were waiting for.
Yeah.
And I think this is the WTF period of Obama's administration. What the hell? I'm going out. I might as well do something good.
Right.
And I think that's what's happened with these regulations.
It's the FTL, find the legacy segment of the administration. It happens every presidency in the last remaining years, couple of years of their presidency.
But it's especially stark with President Obama because he did so little in the first 6 years.
And yet said he was going to do so
exactly.
much.
Exactly.
You know what? Okay, I don't want to get political here.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. I think he deserves more credit for the health care act.
Yes, he does. I agree.
I think that
I absolutely agree.
And I know it's Obamacare, and Fox News thinks it's a really bad thing. But I have to say that was something I never thought, and I don't think anybody ever thought would become the law of the land.
Yep.
And while it's not single-payer health care, which is clearly what needs to happen, it's a huge step in that direction.
Yeah.
And millions of people who were not covered by any health insurance are now covered.
And he also deserves blame for the website.
End of political.
Yeah. But in terms of technology in particular, I think there's been a lot of movement in Washington, both from Wheeler and from President Obama, in the right direction.
Yeah.
Whether you're Weirdly on the left enough. Or the right. I personally hate it when these things get sort of owned by the propagandists who want to divide everybody.
Can we credit the internet population and all the comments for this? Do we get credit for this?
I think there's a lot of credit to be given to, yeah, because essentially these are the people who are paying attention, who have a lot of money. Silicon Valley has a lot of money.
We sat up and we said, we want this.
Yes, exactly.
And I think maybe Wheeler and Obama said, oh, and these people vote?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they give money?
And they give money.
Which they need to.
And they lobby.
And they lobby.
Item three on your list, hotels. Marriott gave up.
Yes.
Hotels cannot block your Wi-Fi hotspot. Marriott said, okay, all right, all right. Again, credit the internet community.
Wasn't there some fine print to that, though, Mike?
Not that I'm... I mean, essentially, the Marriott actually implemented it only in one hotel. They were fined $600,000 for that. But and this is not... this hasn't been formally established yet. But in separate speeches, FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel and Tom Wheeler both said in very clear terms that blocking should not be allowed. They basically pointed out their intention to not allow it. And what was really refreshing was that Rosenworcel actually said that we need a lot more unlicensed spectrum that can be used for things like personal Wi-Fi hotspots. And so the FCC, at least those two on the FCC, I think those are the two most influential chair people. They are very much in favor of no clamping down on personal use. Like, you know, a Wi-Fi hotspot is essentially where you go and you plug into the hotel's network and then you turn it into a Wi-Fi hotspot that five people can use in your room, or one person can use with five devices, whatever it is. And they're basically saying, we're all favor. This should not be restricted in any point, either by the amount of available airwave, frequencies, or by the policy of whatever hotel you're staying in. So this is really a really great direction for the FCC to be going in, because it was unestablished. I mean, it was essentially something that was an open question. Can companies who provide internet connectivity as one of the benefits or services that they provide force you to pay for each device that is on that network? And now the answer is no, they cannot, which is great. So,
item four, you don't have to die needlessly. Thank you, FCC.
Yes.
Oh, wait a minute, because emergency personnel can't locate you indoors. I didn't even know about this.
Yeah.
No, I didn't either.
The FCC approved new rules that require carriers to, within 2 years, start using technology. So they're essentially giving benchmarks for the carriers. Within 2 years, they have to be able to provide the location of a 911 caller within 50 meters in at least 40% of cases. Okay? That means it's all going to be mushed together, and they're going to have averages. And if that requires lots of indoor location technology. And so they have to allow this in order to make sure that people can find, emergency workers can find people who need help.
Which also means, tell me if I'm wrong, that's where the Wi-Fi address sniffing stuff comes in handy, right?
I'm sure it does, and I'm sure that all the technologies for indoor location.
Yeah, I wonder
how
they're going to do that, actually.
Yeah. All that has not been hammered out. There's obviously a million ways to do indoor location, but they're basically throwing it at the carriers and saying, you have 2 years to really make indoor location work for emergency personnel.
Within 50 meters.
Yeah.
In 40% of the cases.
Yeah.
You still have a 60% chance of dying needlessly. But, hey, that's better than nothing. Airplane Wi-Fi. We talked about this with Nick Bilton. Nick was on Twitter on Sunday. You can give Nick a lot of credit for SkyMall going bankrupt. Because he, by rattling the cage and using his bully pulpit at the New York Times, managed to convince the FAA to allow airlines to, leave your device on during takeoff and landings. And that's why SkyMall went bankrupt, they said, because nobody read the catalog anymore, because they could just continue to stare at their iPad, their iPhone, their Kindle.
Yep. Yep.
So Nick takes credit for putting SkyMall out of business. Now Nick's got a new campaign, slow, overpriced Wi-Fi on airplanes. And he said, I know. I've heard the Louis C.K. bit. We should all be insanely grateful. We're flying 7 miles high through the air at 600 miles an hour. And gee, the Wi-Fi sucks.
Yeah.
But there is a technology.
That's right. The FCC recently approved a new service from Gogo called Tuku or 2KU, and that's going to be installed on 1,000 aircraft. Now, most of airplane Wi-Fi, you're beaming it down to the earth, to towers. This beams it up to satellites, and it's much, much faster, up to 70 megabits per second, which is almost certainly faster than our homes. It's really fast
Wi-Fi. JetBlue is rolling this out right now, right?
Yes. And Gogo says that it'll be available to airlines in the second half of this year broadly. And so this is going to be there are going to be lots of airplanes in the sky where you log in and it's going to be way faster than your house.
You can watch us.
You know,
live.
I saw a video from I think United that showed the retrofit for a plane to put in Wi-Fi. I can't believe how hard it was. The amount they had to tear out to put the Wi-Fi in.
Yeah,
I understand why they charge. I said this to Nick. I said I understand why they charge so much. The fuel surcharge alone. I mean, the hundreds of pounds of new equipment they have to put in. It must cost them some money to offer this Wi-Fi.
Yeah. But they can use it themselves as well.
I wish I could just use miles for it. I would buy it more freely with miles.
You know, I noticed that hotels are increasingly offering free Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that'll happen on planes too. If you were the first, if JetBlue said, look, free internet on all our flights, and it's this new 2KU.
Yeah.
I think that I would absolutely be more likely to buy a ticket on JetBlue.
Plus, look at the money you save on providing content. You'd have to show movies and all that kind of stuff. Of course, that's their marketing.
Well, that's already happening on United, Mike.
Yeah, yes.
Now, give you now on United, and I am global services on United. I am the highest level.
Wow.
I'm that a-hole who gets on the plane first.
Yes.
Yes.
All of you be damned.
Do you have to sit in a stroller to do it, or are you allowed
to walk? Senior type.
I know. Excuse me. Are you global services? Oh, excuse me. I am.
You go before babies. He gets on before babies.
I get on before the pilot. It's my plane for 2 minutes. But you know, I think that the Wi-Fi would be a great benefit for the very frequent flyers. I think it's a benefit that you can use, and the cash they get is limited. And you're right, Mike. You now can download the United app, and then when you get on the plane, when it's equipped with Wi-Fi, that's how you can watch movies.
Yeah,
I actually enjoy not getting online on an airplane. I just put on my headphones, listen to music, and relax. It's one of the few places I can get disconnected, so
those
I don't really care.
Days are numbered.
Yeah, I guess so.
But now you can use the Wi-Fi to watch a movie without having to download it to your tablet. Because it's provided
by
the airline.
You know, I know it's 70 megabits, but remember, that's 70 megabits shared among all the passengers on the plane. You're the one, you Mr. Global Services, is going to ruin it for all of us.
Right.
You'll be Skyping, streaming, watching a movie.
There'll be no net neutrality for you.
Number six, the entertainment industry can't use emergency alerts in movie promotions anymore.
That's right. A movie called Olympus Has Fallen. They had a trailer or a commercial for this movie on Viacom, on ESPN, and the FCC fined Viacom and ESPN $1.4 million because this movie trailer used the official emergency alert tone. So with the action heroes and stuff running around on screen, the tone was going,
and then
they said, you can't use the tone. You can't do that.
So I'm a bad person. I turn off Amber Alerts on my phone. I don't want to know. I don't care.
Too depressing.
What are the odds that you're going to see?
You know what happened? Can I tell you what happened here when we were flood, like last month when there was flood warnings? Every phone in the place went off with a flood warning.
Yeah.
Like what? Everybody jump and run because the flood's coming?
Yeah.
No. I turn it off. You can't turn off presidential alerts. But I figure if I'm getting a presidential alert, the end of the world is imminent, right?
The flood warning happened. We were doing TNT live, and it was, you know, it's like we're pretty dry here. We're kind of on a hill.
Yeah, I don't.
We're going to be fine.
I mean, I understand the need. Tornadoes coming. Run for the cellar. But I just turn it off. I'm the bad man who's not going to help find your lost child. I'm sorry. You have to dig to find that emergency. Is it cell broadcast?
I actually think the fact that Facebook is putting Amber Alerts selectively on people's news feeds, I think that's the right place to do it. You're focused on the content. What's happening in my area?
I can't. What am I going to get in the car and look for a beat up Dodge minibus? I'm not going to. So show extreme threats. I have that still. But you know what? I don't want that either. Severe threats? No. Amber alerts? No. But you can't turn off the presidential alerts. So.
But definitely let me know when the cupcakes come out of the oven at the bakery.
That I want to know. Donuts are ready.
I want a Sharknado alert.
Yeah, right.
I'm sorry. I'm such a bad man. You don't have to jump through hoops to complain anymore. Item 7.
Yeah, they have a new website. They have the kind of website that we need.
It won't break down if they get more than a million comments.
The fact is that the new website is okay, but their old website was horrible. It was like from the 90s, and it was like steam-powered and stuff. It was horrible.
Steam-powered.
This is much, much better, and you can go and complain and whine about any company that is providing services that the FCC is involved with.
There should be a checkbox, though, for a zombie apocalypse.
Yes.
That I would like to know about ahead of time.
Right.
We're going to take a break, come back with more. Jeff Jarvis, Mike Elgin, Leo Laporte talking Google and the Googleverse and net neutrality. This is the one place, really, I find when I bookmark news, I bookmark a lot of stories for this show because this is the catch-all. We could talk about anything on this show.
And even if we didn't, Google itself is a massive generator of news stories.
It all has to have to do with Google. Yeah. Actually, I did want to mention, and I'll probably mention this on Twitter as well, but Monty Ohm, who worked at Rooster Teeth, who was an animator, you've seen his work on Red versus Blue. He was doing a new animated web series called Ruby. Very tragic, 33 years old. He passed away, fell into a coma, had an allergic reaction during a medical procedure and never recovered. So very sad, 33 years old, Monty Ohm. And you may not know the name, but you almost certainly know his work in Red versus Blue. And apparently, Rooster Teeth is going to continue Ruby, RWBY, and continue production of that. So I thought I'd make a mention of that. You can't turn these alerts off, sorry. But you know what else you can't turn off? You can't turn off the snacks. The snacks just keep a-coming. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Nature. Oh, new one. Ah, Nature Box time. Asiago. Look at that. Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps.
What is an Asiago?
Asiago cheese is a fabulous hard cheese. A little bit like Romano. It's a sharp. It's delicious. Yeah. Italian bistro pretzels. Garlic and Parmesan cheese flavored pretzel bites. Pistachio power clusters. You know what? There's one thing in common. Sweet coffee kettle popcorn. Savory Asiago and cheddar and cheese crisps.
Ooh.
Crisps. Spicy.
Coffee kettle popcorn.
I know.
Ooh.
But there's one thing all of these have in common. They're nutritionist approved. Never any high fructose corn syrup. Never any saturated fats. Only the good stuff. And it's in resealable bags. If you are going to the candy machine around this time every day, don't. Stop. Stop the insanity. Get Nature Box delivered to your door. Deliciously wholesome snacks with great flavors. And as I said, spicy, savory, sweet. But they also have snacks for various dietary needs. There's gluten-free snacks, vegan snacks. You get to pick. In every case, no artificial flavors, no artificial colors, no artificial sweeteners, no trans fats, no high fructose corn syrup. So in the afternoon when you're hungry, grab a chocolate banana chip or a Kung Bao pretzel or a lemon pucker pistachio. If you go to naturebox.com/twit right now, you can get a complimentary trial box of five of their most popular snacks. You'll just pay $2 for the shipping. Delicious. It'll give you a really good idea of what NatureBox has to offer. And then, I think, subscribe. You can even get more than a box a month. We get like $8 a month now. We get so many because we've hooked the whole staff on them. Naturebox.com/twit for your free sampler. Get it today. Google earnings. I don't think I buried the lead. I don't think this was such a big, huge deal. We talked about Apple earnings last week, and that was a huge deal. Largest profit in history of any company. But people are saying Google did not have a great quarter. They missed the analyst estimates.
Yes. They're doing well. People expect a lot from them. I think that they had a lot of when the larification of Google when Larry Page took over, there was a big push. They were kind of in the doldrums, and then there was a big push of aggressive cutting of dead wood, and then, you know, launching new products and so on. And that seems to have fizzled out a little bit. The problem with Google is that they seem, I think that investors are worried about, is that they launch all these different, they're in everything. They're curing cancer. They got self-driving cars. They have blimps and balloons and all this kind of stuff. And yet they're completely dependent upon advertising online. And it's such a fickle market. It's such a dangerous place to be.
Yes, Mike. But I think YouTube and Play are now up to like, is it $8 billion, $4 billion each year? You know, it's still, the percentage is shifting. I think the bigger worry is that the price per ad is going down.
Price per click, too.
And not going down
as fast as it was, right? It slowed a little bit.
Yes.
A little bit. It's down 3% versus Facebook, pardon me for a second here, is up 335%.
Yeah.
Now, that was low, but the momentum, Facebook has momentum. It has the mo. On mobile, it has it on yes. price per ad. And that's really the issue that I think is worrying. Google's still an incredibly large, growing, profitable company. It's just, I think, a little bit of worry about the mo.
And everybody's eating into their business. I mean, they're losing market share in the United States slowly, but they're losing it to Yahoo and Bing and others, believe it or not. Yahoo's growing. And it seems like no matter what Google does, other companies are aggressively getting into it, even areas where you thought nobody else would get into that. I mean, we just had a story on Tech News Today this morning that it looks like Apple might have Street View cars, and it might even be launching a product called Apple Search. I think that neither of those things are 100%. They're maybe 50-50 at this point. But if you go through each of Google's traditional businesses, what they do, whether it's search, whether it's email, whether it's any of the things that they do, there are a lot of powerful companies getting into that business and potentially chewing away at their market share. Not going to replace them as the leader in some of those areas, but, you know, just gnawing away and eroding their dominance. And I think that's one of the things that some are worried about. I mean, of course, you know, these are good problems to have. We're talking billions of dollars. But again, I think that the investors are right to be nervous about the heavy reliance on advertising. It's still 80-something% plus percentage of their revenues from advertising. And it's like that can just dry up and change overnight. I think one of the biggest success stories and biggest areas of potential is YouTube, of course, because everybody's trying to get into, you know, this is what Facebook is trying to do with all the video, what Twitter and others are trying to do with video. They're all trying to compete with the attention-grabbing power of YouTube, right? Because it's just so many hours spent with eyeballs on that. And, you know, they're going to continue to be a super successful company, and they could be on the brink of diversifying their sources of revenue and profit. But so far, I don't think they're diversifying it fast enough.
Well,
by the way, I don't think that's a Street View car. I think it's a self-driving car.
You really think Apple would be in the self-driving car?
I don't know why they would, but I just feel like it is. Look at the stop.
Yeah, it does. You're right.
The way it stops, I mean, you can't tell. The way it accelerated the minute that car pulled away, it keeps exactly the same stopped distance. I think it's a self-driving car. It doesn't look like a Street View car.
Is it too much to ask for both?
I would trust Apple and Google to make a self-driving car a lot more than I would trust Uber.
Why would – yeah, and Uber is apparently in that business too. I don't know why Apple would either do Street View or
– they have Apple Maps.
Yeah.
And they don't like Google. They don't like to depend on Google. I don't think – I really can't see Apple getting into the transportation.
If they were doing a Street View, you'd see a lot more of these.
Well,
seen two in the wild.
I think, you know, I talked about this with Katie Benner this morning on Tech News Today. I think that there's a strong possibility that they're dipping their toe in the water. They got billions to throw around. Why not just check it out and see what it's like? See how this might improve maps. If it works in San Francisco, maybe we'll, you know, throw $1 billion at it and go nationwide.
But the difference, Mike, I think, is that Google's in a better position to monetize local because it has the advertising structure. For a huge mass
Salesforce.
Apple's really not there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Google Google has $64 billion in cash, good position for acquisition. Yep. Their tax rate significantly lower than Apple's. The effective tax rate was 16%. Apple was somewhere around 26 or 27%, I think.
Yeah, but all those Irish sandwiches and all that stuff, that's
Google's
all going to go
good with that.
Yeah, yes.
It's going to go away. In fact, we talked on Twitter about Was it on Twitter? No, yesterday on MacBreak Weekly about the fact that there are two motions afoot to tax these overseas earnings.
Yep.
President Obama has suggested a 14% tax, and then Nancy Pelosi has suggested, along with Rand Paul, of all people, has suggested a lower, I can't remember what it was, 4% tax, but a one-time only tax that would allow repatriation at no cost.
Which is not going to make the Europeans happy.
Right.
Well, and that's what we had.
Because what they'll do is they'll just declare all the revenue to be American revenue.
Right.
And
we had an actual foreigner on the show, Rene Ritchie, who's from Canada. And he said, you know, this sets a bad precedent for a country taxing income from another country. And so I think that probably this is a non-starter.
This is going to be a fight.
Yeah. Anyway, so
let me just say this about Google. In full disclosure, I own Google stock. I ain't selling it. It's going to do amazingly for a long time to come, I still believe.
I think you're right.
And would you buy Facebook stock?
Yeah. I wish I bought it long ago.
Right.
Yeah, I think you know, the thing is about Facebook that as a user, I'm not as engaged as I wish I were to fully understand where Facebook is and it's going. You know what I mean? That's my issue there. I mean, I'm engaged in Google Plus. Mike and I are the two wackos in the world who are. With Facebook, I delve in all the time. I just am not as into it as I think I should be to understand where their business is going.
But, you know, Facebook.com is not where their business is going. Their business is going in a million different apps, and they're really aggressive, and they're being successful. And I would definitely buy Facebook stock. And I think they just their monopoly on everybody is growing to the point of no return. They, you know, nobody cares how bad Facebook is. That's what everybody is. And so you got to be there. And it's just,
what about the argument we hear, though, Mike, all the time? Oh, but my kids aren't on Facebook. Now they're on WhatsApp. And they're on Instagram. Is that the answer?
Yeah, they're also not using email, but they will. They'll come around.
They are using Snapchat. I know it for a fact because Nick Bilton told me so. And if you haven't seen Nick Bilton's Snapchat instruction to me on Twitter on Sunday, you gotta watch.
But you know, you really know what the kids,
I'm a believer. The kids use Snapchat.
You'll know that kids are using Snapchat when Facebook buys Snapchat.
Didn't Facebook try to buy Snapchat?
They did. But, you know, it's like, you know, maybe they'll throw $20 billion at it or something like that. What I'm saying is that Facebook is, whenever they see a category that is threatening their, you know, where people are going, they'll go and snap it up before people can go there, essentially.
At WhatsApp. The kids aren't as dumb as they look. And they're also very fickle. So they're both smart and fickle. And I talked to my son Henry, he's 20. You have a young son, two young sons, so you kind of know too. But I had Henry over the Christmas break, and about six of his friends, all the same, all college students. I said, "Do you use Facebook?" "No, that's what our parents use."
Mm-hmm.
"Do you use Twitter?" "We use it to message each other for fun. It's a hoot. They don't use it the same way we do." "Do you use WhatsApp?" "No." One guy used it with his French girlfriend. That's it. "What do you use? Snapchat?" "All the time. A little bit of Instagram, but mostly Snapchat all the time."
But Snapchat is the social network for fickle people, as you said.
Yeah.
And it's like once they have kids and the kids, you know, Facebook.
Maybe they'll come to Facebook.
Facebook is the inevitable. That's interesting. That's where the gravitational center of the black hole is. I mean, it's like if people get sucked into it one way or the other, eventually. Most people do, not everybody. And so, when you're like Henry, you're in college, you got a bunch of young friends, probably half his friends he met within the last 2 years.
There are no baby pictures. You're right.
You know,
you're right.
And it's like, you know, that's a place where you can come and go. Next year, it'll be something else. I guarantee it. There'll be another platform that they will have left Snapchat for.
Well, that's what I mean. They're fickle, so you can't really predict.
Wow. Do me a favor and just go to Snapchat.com right now.
I don't think there is a web interface.
There is. And what's striking about it is the big media brands that are there.
Oh, yeah, this just happened. Have you seen?
Yeah, this is phenomenal.
Have you seen Katie Couric and what she's doing on Snapchat?
A little bit, yeah.
I think it's very intriguing. Let me show
you. I think it's very interesting.
She's doing news on Snapchat. So they just added on Snapchat I've been logged out. I got to log in. Well, So what she does is, you know, you only get, how long is it? 10 seconds per snap. And they die, by the way, after 24 hours, even if nobody looks at them. She's doing one story, very nicely produced. In fact, there must be a tool, like a desktop tool for these brands. Because there are people doing, like, content on Snapchat. That's what you're seeing here.
Yeah.
So, okay, let me go back into Snapchat.
Yeah, they're using Snapchat YouTube Discover. Stars.
Yeah, here's Snap. You press the Discover button. These are all the different brands, CNN, Comedy Central, Cosmopolitan. But here's Yahoo. Watch what, I don't know if you'll be able to hear this, but watch what Katie Kirk's doing. It's really, or I guess Yahoo's doing, we should probably say.
A TransAsia flight carrying 58 hits a highway bridge before crashing into a river in Taiwan. 23 are dead, 20 missing.
That's a
but
news
there
story.
Are survivors.
Yeah, now it's going to repeat. But then if I want, I swipe to the next one.
The suburbs of New York City strikes a car on the track.
Jeez.
To flee. A commuter train in the
so that repeat, and then I swipe again, another story. Now, I don't know what value, I don't know if they can monetize this. I don't, it's obviously, I think.
Certainly branding. I mean, Katie.
Well, I asked Katie Nick needs- on this, because Nick is just wrote a New York Times piece singing Snapchat's praises. I said, are these brands wasting their money? He said, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is great for Snapchat, but I got to tell you.
But
not for Katie Kirk. Here's why. Because, I think that Marissa Meyer hiring her expected it would draw audience to it, but they've got people have to know she's there,
right?
Yeah,
and once she's there and interested, I think that's branding that's important.
Do you really think that anybody uses Snapchat goes, oh, there's Katie Kirk, she's on Yahoo News now?
Let me do another full disclosure. Is that Katie is in fact and indeed an extremely nice person, and I imposed like crazy on her for her to speak to my daughter's school about women in media, and she agreed to do it. So I love Katie right now.
I do
Katie
too.
A hero.
I do too.
Katie's absolutely sweet as can be. She's as nice as she seems.
Did she ever find out what internet was though? That was
was the greatest. That's part of her. That's she. You know, she's willing to make fun of herself, and I think she's trying very hard to be innovative. And so I think there's an audience of people who young people didn't watch Katie Kirk on the Today Show. Right. They didn't watch her on CBS. So she's somebody new. You know, Yahoo News. Who knows? I think it's worth the shot.
I was telling Mike, I think we should do TNT this way.
Yeah, exactly.
We should take the top five stories on TNT and make little Snapchats out of them.
Yeah, it'll take us 5 minutes. So that part of it is interesting. The big brand, the big names, all that kind of stuff, ESPN people, Vice and so on, that's the part that's going to fail, I think, on Snapchat. There's another thing that I think is really interesting, which is that...
I can see my son watching this, because this is just highlight clips. And this is about his attention span. It's 6 seconds.
Yeah.
And so, actually, this seems to me like the ESPN thing makes sense to me.
It does make sense. I'm not sure. The big problem is that people approach Snapchat with a mindset about what they want to do with it. And it's not, it's a communications medium. And so they have an uphill battle convincing people to embrace that as a content, passive content reception medium. But Snapchat is also launching something called Snapper Hero, which are YouTube celebrities like Shonduras McBride and Freddie Wong and others. And what's interesting about that is that these episodes will run for about 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they're trying to, when you see these YouTube celebrities, they're almost like one of your friends sending you a goofy video.
Right.
And so they're trying to train users to use video.
Right.
A lot more, because video is the most powerful medium. It's the most eye-grabbing medium, eyeball-catching and attention-grabbing medium there is. And so everybody's trying to get people to use video, and they're using these YouTube stars to get people to sort of train them into this behavior of sharing videos.
Wow, this is just...
Which is different from Katie Kirk. People are not going to launch news programs when they see Katie Kirk.
Right, right.
What was Nick's argument about the wonder of Snapchat and why Snapchat's... I'll watch it.
He's using Snapchat stories, which I find interesting, which is really kind of the individual's way of doing this, which is doing short little stories that are all linked together. So if I could actually do one, if I could figure... The other thing that's weird about Snapchat is the user interface is bizarre. I don't know how to get out of anything. All right, here we go. So I can record something. We'll do something real quickly here. Flip the camera around. It's another Snapchat story from Twit. And then I can add, I could add text or whatever. And then you add it to this. And now it's part of a story, which anybody can watch. You can have lots of pieces in your story. Just very much like the Katie Couric thing or the ESPN thing. People can subscribe to you. It's not, you know, messages from friends. So Baratunde is doing that. Actually, I wish I could show you Bilton's yesterday, but it's gone. That's the other thing that's weird, is that it goes away, right? So this is Snapatunde. He's using a lot of text. I don't know. There's something interesting about this. Nick really feels like this is a communications medium for a new generation, and that it's the kids. And of course, as you know from being in media, Jeff, for years, everybody wants the kids.
Yep.
How can we get the kids? What are the kids doing?
Why would anybody want the kids?
I don't know. Screw the kids. That's why I turned off Amber Alerts. We're going to take a break. I've decided my new persona is going to be grumpy. We're going to take a break, come back with more. We've got a good panel, I tell you. It's always great with Jeff Jarvis, Mike Elgin, talking the Google, talking about stuff. But first, let's talk a little bit about LegalZoom.com. If you're starting a business, if you've got a family, legal costs can really eat you alive. In fact, probably it's enough that it's kept you from getting that will or the healthcare power of attorney or a financial power of attorney. Maybe you've got a business, but you haven't created a limited liability company or an S-Corp or a C-Corp yet. Well, LegalZoom makes it easy. They're not a law firm. They actually are self-help services at your specific direction. So you go to LegalZoom.com and you start getting your life organized. A great place to start, protecting your family. Take control of your family's future. Make a will or a living trust. LegalZoom makes it easy. There's no more affordable or easier way to make your family, to make sure your family's legally taken care of. You can also get your business in shape, trademarks, patents, incorporation, all very affordable. Now, from time to time, you might want an attorney to ask a few questions. If you like more help, LegalZoom can connect you with an independent attorney in many states. LegalZoom's not a law firm, but these pre-negotiated fixed-rate prices are very affordable to get answers from an attorney as well. I think LegalZoom's got it all. Everything you need. I want you to visit LegalZoom.com. Get your family or your business protected. Do the things you need to do, much less expensive than you'd ever imagine. And when you use the offer code TWIT, you get $10 off at checkout. LegalZoom.com. Don't forget to use the offer code TWIG. Did I say TWIT? TWIG. When you check out, I'll save you $10. It's a really great idea. Project Tango. What is Project Tango?
That's the phone thing, isn't it?
Is this the era?
3D mapping.
No. Oh, yeah, it's 3D mapping.
Oh, that's the 3D mapping. That's right.
It's a physical hardware prototype device that has powerful chips in it that essentially can very quickly 3D map indoor spaces, which can be used for a million things, like for gaming, for augmented
maybe
reality.
E911
stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So they're spinning it out. Means it's still part of Google, but it's just no longer going to be in the advanced technology group. It's going to be kind of a little bit more real, I guess.
Yeah, right? when this happened to Google Glass, everybody said Google Glass was dead. Mm-hmm. When they said it's a real product now, everybody said, "See, it's dead." No, it's a real product now. They're going to sell this. Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, this is a device that is a something of a reference platform. So they're going to basically
put it on a smartphone. It looks like it's
Android. Yes, it is. It is.
Wow.
It's a modified phone that has graphics chips in it that, until a year ago or 2 years ago, only existed in very powerful computers. So it's high end, kind of expensive, but you can imagine. Unbelievable. Like when Microsoft rolled out the HoloLens, everybody said, wow, this is the future. This is amazing. Yes, that is the future. That experience is going to be a massive platform. Just like you said, Leo, on several shows, that this is a whole new platform. But I'm not so sure that Microsoft is going to own it. This is going to be enabling that sort of device. You'll be able to plug in a headset into this thing and walk around with this thing.
I just think that the opportunity for sight impaired people.
Yes.
is unbelievable.
So you use this not only to map, but once mapped, you can use it to navigate around. You can walk around in here.
Take me to the bathroom.
Wow.
You know, just right there.
Right.
The power of that. And then put in things like Internet of Things.
Yeah.
So it would give you, it would say, okay, walk three steps and turn left, that kind of thing?
No.
It'd be haptic.
It will not only know where the hall is, where the door is, it'll know that there's a toy truck right in front of you.
Right.
Don't step on that. Wow. Walk around the dog is walking right. I mean, it's real time.
So it's seeing as well as something that's already recorded. Wow.
Oh, yeah, and it's constantly mapping and recording and seeing all at the same time. It's not instant, but it's relatively high fidelity.
Yeah.
And it's in a mobile phone. So
do you think this will be involved with the Leap Motion technologies that Google also has invested in, or is that a separate kind of thing?
I'm pretty sure that that's a separate kind of thing.
This is all the stuff the investors said. Get out of this stuff. Stick to your knitting.
Yeah, right? they were wrong about
that. You're spending money on this. What are you, nuts?
I actually think that I have a feeling that the Leap Motion is probably a little bit ahead of Microsoft's HoloLens.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think this is related to Leap Motion. This is all about making a sort of indoor mapping like highly mobile. And, you know, I don't think your Galaxy S7 is going to have this technology in it. I don't think this is going to be a
consumer product. Yeah, it looks like it's a dedicated thing.
Yeah, right? It'll be a higher-end device. Right. But
maybe it will be in something like a Galaxy S7. They've got to find ways to put stuff...
That's a good point.
...to distinguish the next generation of phones. We've already kind of hit the wall on what new stuff you can do.
Yeah.
So there's still Project Era... but Project Tango exits the Advanced Technology and Projects Group to become perhaps a real product.
Well, what's interesting, too, is now imagine Street View.
Right.
Brought inside, fully mapping the inside world.
Right.
And, you know, a mall. That then you start to map to merchandise.
As long as we're talking blue sky, this is another project out of Google's X projects. Google is making human skin.
Yes.
So that
they can cure cancer. They have a cancer. They're working on a type
detect
of...
Detect cancer.
Detect cancer, yes, I'm sorry.
Wait a minute. So they've been making synthetic human skin to create a wristband...
Yes.
...that can detect cancer or heart attacks or other diseases...
Right.
This is a little creepy. This video from The Atlantic shows two disembodied arms.
It's the beginning of Google making human beings. That's what it's about. Come on, let's be honest now.
Wow. They use Google nanoparticles. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. These synthetic skin strips are using nanoparticles to search in my body for disease?
No.
Oh.
The skin strips.
That's what it says here.
The skin strips are being used to test this technology that uses nanoparticles to detect cancer.
Well, they don't have the nanoparticles yet.
Right.
But they want to be ready with the skin strips.
The condensed version is that they're working on technology that will enable a bracelet to detect cancer using magnetic nanoparticles.
But swallow the pill.
Yeah,
containing
right.
the nanoparticles.
Right. So the arm and the skin they have the same sort of absorbing properties as human skin and other qualities of human skin, so they can test it without doing something weird to some real human's wrist. So the artificial skin, the artificial arm part of it is a test dummy for their technology that would detect cancer with a bracelet. It's a search engine company. Of course they're doing this.
Of course they're doing it.
Google is going to replace you not with a robot, but with an artificial human. That's it. Let's just, you know, be honest.
Advertiser support.
That's what we feared, and it's happening.
I'm kind of thrilled that, and is this Larry, or is it
Sergey?
Sergey.
I'm kind of thrilled that Sergey has decided, I got more money than God. What should I do with it? I'm going to, you know, blue sky stuff, support blue sky stuff. And better yet, instead of just leaving Google and, you know, having it in a secret lab in a mountain volcano somewhere, I'm going to do it inside Google.
I think it's more than that. You know, I think it's Bell Labs.
Yeah.
I think it's the role that AT&T had at once in this country where we're going to do things about space and we're going to invent the transistor. And
was Bell Labs stuff as goofy as this?
There was not quite as goofy, but there was pure research. There was absolutely pure research.
And Unix came out of it. Yep. C came out of it. Much of what we use as modern computing came out of Bell Labs. As you said, the transistor.
But I think that what Bell Labs did was all about computing and electricity and that sort of thing.
Right.
What this is all about is I think that Sergey, and in particular, and Google in general, tend to see Google as the experts in using massive data sets to do creative things to solve problems in a way that used to require a lot more money, a lot more people, and a lot more time. And so, you know, I think that they see this as identical to the search engine business, because you're basically doing lots of data crunching and figuring out all these things. Like, remember, Sergey's wife, they're still married, runs 23andMe. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they have had many conversations about how you could use big data number crunching to figure out all kinds of correlations about health. Oh, people who are left-handed and also live in Utah, you know, never get cancer, whatever. I mean, whatever the, you know, these unexpected... And they're right about that. He's right about that. You can make you can do so much good in the world.
Right. And by the way, there's probably some profit in all of this too. I mean,
I'm sure there is.
I think one of the things Google does recognize, we've talked about this before, that the search thing isn't going to last forever, and you've got to have the next thing. And I'm sure that's what Bell Labs is up to. So here's an interesting thing: you can be your own technical director. Jason Howell has always dreamt someday of being able to watch video and switch the angles. This is a YouTube performer named Madeline Bailey. She's the first to have switchable angles. So right now we're on this angle. But let's say you'd like to see a side view. Wow. Does it... Of the same... Now, this is the same video.
Talking about the YouTube Music Award.
And now he's talking, so let's go look at him. But you wonder what she's thinking while Arnold is talking? Or let's get all of the... It's too bad this is wasted on such... horrible programming.
Yeah, well, imagine
he's bringing the fanny pack back there.
What
and
the
it's just
hell?
Three cameras. Imagine the 30 cameras you have.
I would love to be able to do this. What do we have to do to get into this project? We actually have content.
Yeah.
We almost already have this with the drop cams.
Yeah.
You
we
can
do.
Just go there
you
and
can.
Switch
we have six drop cams. You can just switch from. But not as. I like how fast this is.
Yeah.
This is like. You know, I've always thought this would be kind of interesting. We actually have dreamt of doing this for a long time at Twit since almost day one. We're 10 years old, but I realized I had to have a separate stream for each camera. And I was thinking of a user interface where you could do that, where you could cut back and forth.
Then you got to have a website.
Yeah, but we can't afford a website, so.
Oh, you had to bring that up.
Oh, please.
Sorry.
Switchable angles, says Computer Vision or CompuVision, our chat room. Switchable angles was a part of the DVD standard 20 years ago, just nobody did it.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember that.
I don't
remember that dimly.
Well, even before the DVD, what was the big the big disc?
Laserdisc.
Yeah, Laserdisc.
And Blu-ray also has angles.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like
most people just want to watch, though.
I feel like this is your job, Jason.
Whatever happened to the lean back experience?
Yeah, it's my job. Yeah. I do it as a job. When I'm at home about to put on a concert, I suppose it's neat to be able to do something like this, but am I really going to sit on my couch or at my computer and watch an hour-long video and switch camera? Like,
you don't want to replace your remote control with a TriCaster, Jason?
Well, but imagine how you could create programming that would be made for this.
Dude, totally, totally.
Well, I think porn could benefit from this.
Oh, yeah.
This is interesting. There it is. All right. There you've seen it. It's an experiment. Madeline Bailey is doing it on her YouTube channel. YouTube Music Night performance there. And that's how you switch around. It's cool. I mean, it's not a hard thing to do. I think Alex Lindsay did something like this as well. What is Smart Lock? Should we do this story? What is Smart Lock?
Oh, this is driving me nutty.
What is Smart Lock?
Smart Lock is so that you don't have to unlock your computer when your phone's nearby if you have Android 5 and if you have Chrome.
Oh, I like it.
Okay, so you would think that I, of all people, would be able to do that.
Yes,
oh,
Mr.
No,
Pixel.
No, because guess what?
What?
Google Apps accounts get screwed again, and you got to march through all kinds of hoops and light them on fire, and I still haven't been able to make it work. I, Google fanboy, have not been able to make this friggin' work. And while I'm at this, something else has changed. So that now, even though I'm signed into my apps account, every window is my apps account. It's all apps accounts. When I open a new Google app, it defaults to my Google Plus Gmail account. So I try to open something in Docs. It opens it up in the wrong damned account because Google can't figure this out.
Yeah, sorry. But that's, in other words, this is actually a really cool feature that that gets screwed up when you have multiple accounts because, as you said, Google can't figure that out.
It gets incredibly screwed up, and I still have not been able to get this going. And because there's complicated, you have to go into the apps admin account. There's the Chrome thing, which is hidden in other apps. Then you have to go in there and find the place where you say, okay, you can use this neat new feature. And then you need to restart, and then you need to find it. And I still can't find it.
I don't understand how this is like super different from the feature that, you know, I think they first introduced it on the Moto X where you had the Bluetooth thing, and then you also even had a little magnetic
skip.
Yeah, and but you could also do it with your phone or whatever.
They do that now. In fact, the current Moto X, if you're, you know, it's a trusted Bluetooth network, it just unlocks it.
Yeah. And of course, this concept is going to be huge in the Internet of Things and home automation because this will unlock everything, turn on lights, turn down that. It'll be like Bill Gates' house.
I think you were going to wear your electronic identity.
Yes, and it should be your smartphone.
No, I don't think it's your smartphone. I think your smartphone is just another accessory.
Did you ever get into Bill Gates' house?
No, never did.
I always tried to, but the guards catch me
security,
each time.
Yeah. Because
I remember when he built it, and this was 10, 15 years ago, the idea was you would walk into a room. He would already know what paintings you liked, what pictures you
liked. You'd be issued a pin of some kind, as a device that
you
clip on.
Sense you.
Yeah.
And the paintings would change on the TV screens in the room to match your needs.
Right.
I'm afraid that I'd walk in and be some Thomas Kincaid horrible crap.
Jeff Jarvis.
They think I have no taste.
Painter of light. Yeah. I think that's kind of, I wonder, do you think, like, it's been around, they put it in 15 years ago. Yeah. Like, it's kind of dusty and faded and it doesn't work anymore.
Right. It's
kind of
like a World's Fair. Corner.
It'll be like Tomorrowland at Disneyland.
Welcome. I feel like, what do you think? Do you think, I would like to get into Bill Gates' house now.
Yeah, right.
And like, just see how much of that crap they've just turned off.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that was not a good idea.
Right. I'm sure that's true.
It's not, it's actually not so much the guards, it's the wall and the dogs.
Yeah.
But if I'm working on it.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say that because then they're going to come to the Microsoft police.
No, it's Apple that has the police.
Yeah. I think Microsoft probably has police.
Just get with the program. Use a drone like everybody else.
Yeah. One of Bill's books had a virtual tour of his house, says Fred Flintstone, who has a mighty nice house himself, I might add. He has to do everything with his furry feet. Google's secret weapon in the battle for the Internet of Things, speaking of IoT, academia. According to this article in Fast Company, Tina Amirtha, Google's not adverse to using university brain power for a lot of what it's doing. Maggie Johnson, Google Research's Director of Education and University Relations.
They have a grant program called Open Web of Things to attract talent to the company. You know, they've already hired a huge number of academics. Yes. They're kind of, it's almost
sense.
Borderline brain drain situation. And,
they've always had more PhDs than any company in America, right?
Yes.
Well, you know, there's an interesting precedent set to just today that, I'm forgetting his name, a former Guardian journalist who does visualization at Twitter is now also, in addition to that, a contributing editor at Vox. He's going to keep his Twitter job, but also be a contributor to Vox, which is interesting because I wonder what other media companies will think about that. Well, you know, you're working for Vox. Are you going to give us the nice stuff or not?
Yeah, really. Google's giving – we mentioned that Intel is spending – how much was it? $300
million? It was $300
million, to encourage diversity in technology. Google, not to be left behind, has said, we'll give $775,000.
Million.
No.
It's a thousand? Million.
Yeah, a thousand.
Yep.
That was all.
They're giving it grants to Code 2040.
Google.
That's all. Yeah, you're right.
Intel gave $300 million.
Yep. And that, I believe, was for gender diversity. This is for diversity to get more minorities into technology.
I think Intel does it all.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Do they? Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's my memory, but...
Code 2040 has free training programs for Black and Latino college students.
It's great.
Which is great.
And I think this is the kind of thing, although it's surprising how little it is for in terms of Google dollars, Google bucks, but they would love to hire more women and minorities, and it's a systemic, deep cultural problem that is more than just hiring people who, you know. And so this is a little part of it. They, you know, boosting engineering students at the college level is one tiny way to do it. But it's barely going to touch the issue as far as I'm concerned.
Same in our industry, Mike. You know,
yeah.
CUNY prides itself on being diverse, and we are highly diverse, but we can never do it enough.
Yeah. The problem with journalism, journalism has a special problem in that the education that you need in order to be a journalist, you can make a lot more money not being a journalist.
Amen. That's exactly the problem.
And so if your parents immigrated from another country or something like that, and you're the one person to ever go to an American university, and you go through it all and you have all this education, everybody's going to be disappointed if you take that vow of poverty and become a journalist. They're going to want you to go to Wall Street or go into, you know, do something where you're going to make a lot more money. So that's a big, big problem. Not so much in technology, but that still exists as well, because people think that everybody in Silicon Valley makes a ton of money. They don't really. Good engineers make pretty good money, but when you have to live in Silicon Valley and pay the cost of living, it ends up being, you know, you barely upper middle class. So it's kind of a big problem, and you know, at least they're doing something. I guess that's something that can be said. But this
it's also an argument to say that break up the Silicon Valley technology ghetto and do development all around the country, which is happening.
Yes, it is, and it isn't. There's a lot of that stuff going on, but there's still no substitute for that intense. Kind of incubator in the air kind of feel in Silicon Valley. There's a lot to be said for that. And there was a study recently that looked at the degree to which that sort of synergistic quality of the culture of Silicon Valley actually had material benefits for the success of companies and stuff like that. It is good to see it being diversified, and every week there's another article that, like, this is the next Silicon Valley, and it's, you know, Des Moines.
Well, speaking of New York, and we're gonna do Twit stuff here soon, I hope. You know, we do now have a robust technology and investment scene in New York, and it does feed on itself, and there's a point of critical mass. But I think we have it now in New York.
I think what's really happening that's kind of skewing the picture is that a lot of what we talk about in terms of technology is writing an app, right? And writing an app, you can write an app if you specialize in something very highly special. You can do that literally anywhere, and you can get, you know, you can get rich. A tiny minority will get rich doing it. A lot of the technology, though, that isn't writing an app, you know, sort of deep enterprise software or real hardware that has to integrate with other things, or, you know, get into the biotech that's happening, a lot of the food technology that's happening in Silicon Valley. That stuff is harder to do when you're, New York is, you know, Silicon Alley is, of course, is a hotbed of technology. Massachusetts, there are a lot of areas like that. But if you talk about outside of the major cities, that's something you really need to go to a place like Silicon Valley or New York City or London or someplace like that, where you can find lots of support and infrastructure, and where you can hire people. You know, a lot of it is, where are the universities that specialize in certain things? I mean, so if you look at New York, one of the things that New York is just amazing at in terms of the population there is the number of people who are in science, especially, oddly enough, science journalism. Mm-hmm. All the science journalists are in New York. And half of those are
true, really?
And half of those are in Brooklyn.
They all work for the New Yorker.
Yes, and it's like and they're very hard to find in Silicon Valley.
That's interesting.
It really is really kind of odd. But again, where are the universities? You know, you're gonna find clusters of certain types of people, are in Massachusetts near Harvard, et cetera. and MIT and so on. Right. And so and let's face it. I mean, Silicon Valley exists because of Stanford.
Right.
So
yeah. What did you think of this editorial from the New York Times yesterday against the right to be forgotten?
I think it's exactly what we've all been saying for several months, and it's nice to see them sort of saying it now, finally. But yeah, that's the basic argument. Once there's a precedent set where governments can say you can't say this on the search engines, everybody's going to want a piece of that. So China and Turkey and Iran, and everybody's going to want to say, well, here's our version of the right to be forgotten. We want people to forget the Armenian genocide.
The Times editorial board wrote, this position is deeply troubling because it could lead to censorship by public officials who want to whitewash the past. It also sets a terrible example for officials in other countries who might want to demand that internet companies remove links they don't like. There's no doubt the internet has made it harder for governments to enforce certain rules and laws because information is not easily contained within borders, but that does not justify restricting the information available to citizens of other countries.
It's a free speech issue. But, you know, back from Davos, the Media Council, of which I'm a member, had an important discussion about freedom of speech, starting with peril to journalists, but also this is right after Charlie Hebdo. It's sobering when you get into a truly international audience how few people around the world hold to the free speech absolutist view that we Americans have. And I think that that's part of where the right to be forgotten comes from, even in a very progressive land of Europe. This idea that there's a balancing of speech, and I don't buy that myself. I think it's very important to say there's a right to remember. It's very important to say you can't control knowledge, you can't rewrite history. I think the Times is a little overdoing it, but I'm really glad they wrote the editorial. Now, at the same time, Google had a frankly handpicked group of people studying this, and without any particular surprise, they said that right to be forgotten should stick to Europe and should not be worldwide.
Yeah.
At the same time that the EU is going to try to impose their will on the whole world. And I say to them, the hell with you. You're not going to affect my speech here. No. Yeah.
I have a theory about that, Jeff. You talked about the idea that Americans tend to be more passionate or more absolutist about free speech than elsewhere, including Europe. And my theory is that that's not entirely the case. I think what's different is that I think Americans take the internet more seriously as a bona fide source of content and information than other places. I think I get the feeling that in Europe they would never, ever try to impose the same kinds of restrictions in novels, in academic studies, in other types of content, other media. But the internet, that's just a confection. It's just this like superficial thing that's annoying. It's not real.
Mike, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's not just the internet. It goes back to when I was a TV critic. I would try to defend television, and people would restrict television in a way that they would never consider doing to books. I mean, I even objected. I even got into a tiff with Ed Markey on a TV show many, many, many years ago about the V chip that's in cable boxes by government regulation. And it never came to pass, my worst fears, but the worst fear was that if you're the so-called Parents Television Council, the Howard Stern enemies, you'll just get every show that you don't possibly like with a scarlet letter with a V on it so that it can be blocked across the market. And technology would be a handmaiden to censorship. So you're right. I think that we hold books to be holy in every other medium, pretty much every other medium. If you consider the kind of censorship that's occurred in movies over the years and television and the internet is seen as less, but it's all speech. Or as the Clue Train Manifesto would say, it's all conversation.
Right. And we see this type of attitude all over the place. For example, there's a video game called Hotline Miami 2, which was banned in Australia because there's a rape scene in it.
Ooh.
Okay. And so there are a lot of people talking about this. The chattering classes are talking about this and saying, oh, well, it's good because, you know, but apply that to novels. Should we say that it should be illegal to have depictions of rape in novels?
Right.
What about books? What about scientific studies about rape? Should those be banned? I mean, where, what is it about video games? And this, by the way, is a this video game is a satire or a criticism of violent video games like Grand Theft Auto. That's what the game is. It's using the video game format to sort of expose to ridiculous extremes what these games are like. And to ban it on that basically says, okay, this is not a legitimate art form like painting. You would never put such restrictions on painters or photographers or any of the older existing communications media. And this is just an ongoing issue that we're going to have to grapple with. Eventually, I think that, you know, the kid, and by the way, it has to be said, I mentioned that Europeans tend to not take the internet as seriously. I don't think that's the case among most internet European populations. That's yes. Not the people. That's the bureaucrats.
This is really...
who are an entirely different.
This is comedically bloody, this yes. game.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous...
We probably shouldn't show it.
I mean,
I don't want to get banned in Australia.
It's almost 8-bit. I mean, it's...
It is 8-bit from okay. top down. It's very... It's obviously tongue-in-cheek. But I think you raised an excellent point. I mean, I think that comes from a out-of-date notion that video games are for kids.
Yeah.
And that's obviously out of date.
Right.
So... Speaking of kids, Google has bought Toontastic, a storyteller app created by Launchpad Games. They announced it today. They didn't say how much, but they have made Toontastic free. I'm not familiar with it. It's for the iPad. It's a modern-day puppet show. You can record them and share them with others. And Google's working, I guess, on... I don't know what. Maybe this is for the new children's YouTube. I don't know what this is for. Actually, yeah. That might be an interesting thing.
Yeah.
If they have been rumored that they'd be working on a YouTube for kids, maybe let kids make their own videos in this kind of context. It's not the only acquisition. Microsoft, according to TechCrunch today, bought Sunrise, which is a calendar app we've used and recommended. Yeah. We really love on iOS and Android. Earlier, they bought, you may remember, they bought... Acompli, they've turned that into Outlook for iOS. It sounds like they're Microsoft is acquiring other mobile developers.
It's so weird to see Microsoft becoming a company that doesn't
a very
have a
company.
Problem about yeah. other mobile platforms.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I think this is a new Microsoft, and I welcome them.
Yep.
Rolling Stone has teamed up with Google Play to monetize their archives. So Google Play has a magazine stand, which I'd forgotten because I never right. use it. But they're going to take, I guess, archival articles, issues, says 3 to 4 major stories from each archive issue for free on Google Play. And then I guess all the it'd be kind of fun to get old Rolling Stones.
Yeah,
I use Google Play News all the time.
I use the News, which is a really great little app.
I don't.
That replaced Current, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's actually very good. I don't know
whether subscribe to anything in it.
That's the thing. I was just thinking. I used to buy magazines by the pound.
Yeah,
I
me too.
Magazines. I started a magazine, and the magazine stand I used to buy the most from in Jersey City was near my old office. I just saw they tore down and it's gone. You can't find newsstands anywhere. I don't buy magazines anymore. I walk by newsstands now and think I don't even go into them anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't have the reflex to buy them on an app.
Yeah, I'm the same way. It's all about deep links and going article by article, not even site by site, but article by article.
Yeah.
Which it really kind of is a problem, I think, for the long-term health of article aggregators. We used to call them magazines.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
you know what I just did, though? We had so much fun on our vacation reading the New York Times newspaper every morning.
I read it every day.
I just subscribe to the daily delivery of New York Times.
It's a joy.
I really like it.
Yeah. I got today's
isn't it great? And then I get – this is what I used to do when I was a radio talk show host. I would take a razor blade, cut out articles, put them in a folder, bring them to work.
Yeah, morgue file.
Now I keep clicking on the article trying to share it. Nothing happens.
I keep telling people this, and they don't believe me. You know, I look at a screen 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
And it's like it's the most digital, the most technology-obsessed people who need print reading material, like the New York Times.
Well, it is a better interface. You can scan more articles faster.
Yeah.
It seems like there are more articles in the print edition than – I mean, I've been reading the New York Times and Wall Street Journal online for years – it seems like there's more stuff
but
there.
The benefits that the online and digital versions of articles they always pitch as a benefit the idea that you can find what you want, which means that you don't find what you don't think you
There's
want.
There's less serendipity.
And so the
I
New
agree.
York Times in, like on print it. Forces you to go.
Yeah.
I can talk intelligently about all kinds of conflicts and issues around the world that are happening that nobody else has even heard of because they're never
Especially
forced to
Especially international. You're exactly right.
That's right.
Especially international.
We know all about the plane crashes in Taiwan. We know all about the big splashy stuff that has crazy video. We don't know about the little conflicts that are really shaping the world, and it's a real problem.
Jeff, we're trying to support this whole journalism thing you're into.
I think you're holding up. You're extending the past needlessly. The New York Times. We subscribe to the New York Times. The reason we do is because it's cheaper than subscribing to New York Times digital only.
Yeah,
because print subscribers are worth more, so they're artificially pumping up the print. And the New York Times has now hit. They say they're going to hit 1 million. Digital-only subscribers this year, which is very impressive, I must say. It would be much higher if they didn't have that's artificial support for print.
Right. Well, you know, but it has to be said that I think that the real solution that is needed here is not that everybody, like, start reading a black-and-white newspaper again and getting a home delivery and all this stuff. The solution is that we need to figure out a way to make digital devices do what the New York Times does, which is expose you to sort of serendipitously to all kinds of things that you are not thinking of at the moment and aren't necessarily related to the kinds of things that you're normally interested in. I mean, one of the crazy things about the New York Times, and I've been subscribing since I was in college, is that you flip through it and you're seeing stuff that you just would never even think of. Like, you know, happening in stage performances in London. You know, it's every once in a while there are articles like that that are incredibly interesting and very enlightening and related and relevant to other things that you're thinking about and doing and so on that you would never in a million years see if you were using Google's.
Okay, so you're arguing for serendipity, and editors like to think that they are the sole proprietors of serendipity. But I'm going to go to your favorite service. I was on a plane coming back from Davos, and I opened up Google Plus on the plane. I had no Wi-Fi, but I just looked at the page that was already loaded there, and I opened 7 new tabs of interesting things that I saw that when I landed I wanted to look at. Twitter, you get serendipity from that. I think it's interesting that the Play newsstand versus Google News. I mean, Google News is an overload and it's everything, and I don't think they've thought through what Google News can be.
Yeah.
And Play is so brand-oriented. There's something in the middle that will do a better job of giving you serendipity across brands.
People have tried that.
Twitter.
People have tried that.
I mean, Flipboard, but that's still
even Google News, right? Isn't Google News all about cross-brand serendipity?
It's trying to be kind of everything. And it doesn't, you know, the irony to me is that Google News doesn't personalize much.
You guys are overlooking something very important. The New York Times print edition is very soft and absorbent as well.
Yes, it is. You can use it to clean windows. Try that with Google Play.
Try that with my tablet. Oh, by the way.
Yes.
News flash here. The wait is over. My
Nexus 502 as well.
It's a miracle.
Now, wait a minute. Jeez. Now, is that a Verizon? Is that a LTE one?
No. It's not Verizon. It's T-Mobile. Thank you very
much.
But
it is LTE.
It is LTE.
I think because I got it on my Wi-Fi Nexus 7 months ago. Yeah.
Ages.
Okay. So good.
I don't know why I had to wait so long.
Now you can unlock your Chromebook with it.
Don't get me started. Get me started. I'm going to talk to you about websites. You're not nice to me.
By the way, they've already said Android 5.1.
I'm already behind.
It's on the way. Yeah. It's going to ship on Android One phones. What is an Android One phone, Jason? I don't even know what that is.
That's the cheap one in India.
That's in Indonesia?
Yeah, the low-cost Micromax devices in India.
They get Android 5.1 Lollipop before everybody else. Are they trying
to
piss us off?
I like that. That's justice.
are they trying to get us angry here now? Then Nexus devices. When is it going to come? I don't know.
I don't know if we have a date on that.
It's out in Indonesia.
There are devices running 5.1
right
now.
We've been doing that a lot lately. They're launching their Aura smartphone in Puerto Rico.
Well, that makes sense. From what?
From food trucks.
No, you're kidding.
Food trucks are the distribution mechanism.
No, you're kidding me.
I'm not kidding. I'm going. No. We should do bring the Padre and everybody down there.
Wait a minute. You mean you get some fried plantains and an Aura phone?
I hope so.
Okay. All right, I'm done. I think we should. We, I don't want to talk about CyanogenMod. We kind of talked about it before. Microsoft has invested money in them.
There is one note from last week's show. It was after the show, I think, when we mentioned that Microsoft was investing in CyanogenMod.
Yeah. Okay.
I was wondering why CyanogenMod was so hostile to Google. And I have to say that does.
Maybe now you know. Yeah. Or the other way around, Microsoft said, hey, we like these guys. They said they're going to kill Android.
Yeah. Should we have a 5 seconds of silence for Radio Shack?
They've been. This has been the longest goodbye in history.
It's like a Hollywood death scene, isn't it?
Yeah, we knew they were running out of money. Now they're talking about selling some of their stores to Sprint.
Amazon.
Amazon wants to buy a handful. For what, distribution centers?
Distribution centers to show to also as little mini Apple stores to show off their hardware devices, but also mostly pickup locations instead of having lockers, which they tried at 7-Eleven.
They have one test, and I think it's Indiana, Purdue, or someplace.
Purdue and Amherst, both have, and they're not tests; they're all full in.
I actually think this is kind of terrible. Radio Shack was. There were thousands of stores, it was the one place in many areas of the country where you could get. Electronics parts, they kind of got away from that. I think that's one of the reasons. We talked about this like 2 months ago when we first heard they were in trouble. But I feel like they missed the boat. If Radio Shack had said, no, we're going to go after the maker movement. We're going to become an electronics center, a hobbyist center. They might have survived. Becoming another place to buy a smartphone seems like a bad idea.
The problem is that, we're familiar with Fry's out here. Now, Fry's is like, imagine a Radio Shack that's the size of a Costco.
Yeah.
And this really works, especially there's several of them in Silicon Valley. They're packed to the gills. They also sell electronics and vacuum cleaners and
washing machines. Even in areas where people are smart enough and wired enough to buy online, they still go to brick and mortar.
Exactly. The problem with Radio Shack is that they existed in an era where to have an electronic device was to tinker with it in some way or program it or whatever. And nowadays, people just want to buy this appliance and forget about it. Except for the makers. And the makers, the world is so much more complex now. A store that would really serve the maker community would have to be enormous.
Maybe,
And Radio Shacks are tiny. Yeah. They have all these retail outlets, more than 4,000 of them. They used to have a lot more.
4,000? Wow.
But these are tiny little stores that can't really serve. They can have soldering irons and batteries and things like that. But really, a real maker person is, Radio Shack's not big enough to hold all the things they might need. Unless they were 3D printing it, in which case that might make sense.
Maybe this is the right end. They sell it to Sprint. They become Sprint stores, about half of them. The rest, Amazon Shack, they could call it.
Why not sell it to Google? Google, you got the money. Buy these. Put all your hardware devices
barges.
In there.
They were going to build barges.
Well, because they're doing all these weird things. Yeah. No, just go the straight way. Get Radio Shack. Put all your Nexus and your Nest and
put
all
everything
your
in there.
Whatever in there, and people can actually play with them and... Yeah, there
who
you
needs
go.
Who needs the food truck?
There's an outside chance that some of these stores may become co-branded Radio Shack, and remember, Radio Shack's not going out of business; they're declaring bankruptcy. They may co-brand them with Sprint, so they become Sprint Radio Shack stores. That's the dark horse outcome, but that is one of the possibilities here that has to be mentioned.
Brookstone is also evaluating, right? Brookstone's thinking about it.
There's a high tech company for you. Get the massage.
Brookstone is like the next to go.
Exactly. Right.
Out of the frying pan into the fire. Let's take a break. When we come back, I've got a cool tool. Jeff's got a number, and we're going to let Mike find a thing. Look for your thing, Mike. It's got to be here somewhere. Where'd you see it last?
I don't know.
Our show today brought to you by Lynda.com, Lynda.com. I've known Lynda Wyman since the Screensavers days. She is still a great educator. Was doing books on web design and creating a website. They have branched out. Oh, have they branched out. If you go to lynda.com right now, you'll see an amazing array, 4,500 courses on anything you can imagine. Web development, but also photography, visual design, business skills like negotiating, writing a resume, software training, Excel, WordPress, Photoshop. If you're a programmer, what a great place to go to expand your skills. I'm reading, studying up on the Swift programming language at lynda.com. This is my interface right here. All the courses really well produced. They all have transcriptions, which is really great. So you can search the transcription and find the part you want. They divide it up very nicely into a lot of chapters. They seamlessly stitch together, but you can jump right to, you know, you want to know more about creating and using arrays, you can jump right to that part of the course. New courses all the time. If you want to improve your job skills, if you want to ask the boss for a raise or make yourself more marketable, if you're looking to expand your abilities in your hobby, to set new financial goals, to find a better work-life balance, lynda.com has something for everyone. Courses I'm looking at right now is SEO Fundamentals, Google Sites Essential Training, up and running with a Google Cloud platform that teaches you how to develop and host apps, websites, analyze data, create and manage cloud-based databases with Google Cloud. It is incredible. And by the way, if you're a podcaster, look at all the things you can learn, mastering, mixing, live performance, the business of music, the production of music, recording techniques, every kind of music software, every kind of recording software. This is amazing. Logic Pro 10 Essential Training. And by the way, when new stuff comes out, when Logic got updated, immediately they've got courses taught by experts in the business who happen to be great trainers too. Invest in yourself. Sign up for a free 10-day trial at lynda.com. Go to lynda, lynda.com/twig. With your membership, you'll get unlimited access to every single course on lynda.com, including access on iOS and Android devices, new courses as they're added every week, and we've got a 10-day free trial for you. This is a good deal. lynda.com/twig. lynda.com/twig. Somebody's pointing out that Staples is trying to buy Office Depot. I think it really is tough times for brick and mortar now. Really tough.
Yep.
But who was it? Was it you, Jeff? Somebody was saying that the future, if you really want to look at the future of retail, it's in high touch, high service. Mm-hmm. It's not being a place where people go to buy stuff.
Yeah. It's marketing.
It's about marketing. Space. It's about training. It's about creating a relationship. There's so much you can do with it. And I think about the independent bookstores that have survived. They're not trying to compete with Amazon. They're not putting every book on the shelf. They have author book signings, author speaking. They have smart clerks who can help you find the right book. I mean, it's about service. And I think there is an opportunity still for brick and mortar. I don't see every store closing downtown.
When was the last time you were in a Best Buy?
Ages.
Well, go to a Best Buy now. You're going to be amazed. Huge, gigantic space, solely limited to Samsung. Huge space to Microsoft. Small space.
Well, you know why that
Google.
Is.
Because huge space to Sony.
These are
they
basically,
buy that space
it's all,
in stores.
It's all co-op marketing dollars. Sony
co-op
says
co-op marketing. That's what it is.
We want to buy 150 square feet.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
And but Best Buy says if you want to get your products sold, you can either put them with 18 other products in a dusty shelf that no one's paying any attention to, or you can buy set up a store. Apple did this.
Well, and here's the other
gold standard is Apple for sure.
Yeah, here's the other part of the business model. So if you go into Best Buy and you play with the Samsung phone there, Samsung doesn't care whether you buy it in Best Buy or not.
Right.
Samsung says, this is our marketing, this is our touch opportunity to show you the thing, show you how wonderful it is.
Right.
And I've talked in the past, I'm involved with a retail genius named Sean Sampson, who has this vision for the future of retail. I mentioned it in public parts briefly. And he's a visionary about this stuff, and I think that's where retail goes, is toward marketing, and we're starting to see the beginnings of this.
Very interesting.
But retail as a whole, as an industry, becomes much smaller, far more efficient. I don't know about you, but I get frustrated every time a retail space opens up. What goes in? A bank.
Yeah. And in Petaluma, it's antique store. Even the bank has an antique store.
Yes.
But I now work in the center of the universe, if we do say so ourselves, Times Square. I've got to walk 20 minutes to find a bookstore. I got to walk 20 minutes to find
the
Best
sad.
Buy.
That's really
There's
sad.
Nothing to browse. I used to go out at lunch hour when I was pissed off and angry, and I'd calm myself down by browsing. Record store and a bookstore and electronics store. All gone.
That's really sad.
It's life.
But I think that's maybe because of the short-sightedness of the retailers who didn't understand what business they were in. They thought they were in the business of selling goods.
Yes. Maybe Which, by the way, was a really awful business.
Right.
You had a capital risk. You had pilferage. Yep. You had all kinds of awful things going on in retail. Low margins.
Okay, Jeffrey Jarvis. Number of the week.
Have I done something to anger you, boss? Jeffrey.
What's your middle name?
Alan.
Jeffrey Alan Jarvis. You get in here. What's your what's your number of the week?
524 million scolded bad ads killed by Google.
What?
Last year.
Half a billion.
524 million.
What was bad about them?
Okay, I'll tell you. That amounted to 214,000 advertisers, which is interesting to me. That means basically on an average of two ads, yeah. Google kills you.
That's because these people weren't real advertisers. They were malware vendors and things like that.
7,000 right? promoted counterfeit goods.
Yeah.
Down from 14,000 the year before.
Yeah.
Down from 82,000 the year before that, so they say they were making progress. Malicious software was 250,000 sites doing that in general. Then things like weight loss schemes.
You mean those belly fat ads?
Yep.
I got it. Belly fat, I can has it.
And so it's pretty amazing that, you know, Google's the cop of the world. And has to constantly worry about killing bad ads because it's bad for the Google brand. It's bad to rip off the users.
Well, but they've also set up a system where you can anonymously, without any human intervention, buy an ad. So they've set it up so that bad actors have easy access.
Exactly. And they've also been taken to task and fined for bad medical ads. And so they have an obligation to do this. But it's a cost of doing business for them. So I wonder whether Matt Cutts has been involved in that.
It's kind of like spam, but I bet you they have a whole division dedicated.
Oh, I'm sure they do, but it's there's a science of saying how are the bad guys going to act.
Yeah,
so that's my number.
There's his number. Do you want to do a tip or should I?
Either way, I can go.
Go.
Okay.
Go.
Epicurious, of course, is a foodie magazine, and they just a week ago or so updated their website, and now they have updated their apps.
Oh, I wonder if I have the latest.
Well, the Android app has not yet been updated any minute now. The
I've
iOS
been using
app
it for website. Ages. I love the website.
Yes. Very fast.
But that's from 2010.
Yeah.
That version of the app.
Yeah.
The new version is absolutely spectacular.
Let's get an iOS.
There you go.
Let's get a real phone over here
if
and
you
see
can
what
poke
it looks
around
like.
With that.
First of all, they changed to a lighter red.
Yes. So they've got it's a very contemporary design, very high performance.
All around
and so
search.
On. Yeah.
Very fast.
That's exactly it. It's a search that's super good. It's Google-like search. It's not Google, is not the engine behind it, but the quality of the search.
Is this Condi?
It's Condé Nast, yeah.
This is Condé Nast. I was there. I was part of the team at the original Epicurious years and years ago.
So,
a woman named Joan Feeney and Rochelle Udell did brilliant work starting Epi long ago. Yeah.
So the idea is it's a search across a variety of Condé.
Exactly. Yes. So if you hit the hamburger, not the actual hamburger, there you go, and go to home, you'll see that it has this. Okay, so there's
at home.
Yeah, so there's
just
an interface. If you hit the thing right below the search.
Browse by
right
category.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, kid-friendly, quick and easy, healthy food.
Lots of stuff like that.
Choose
they even
a main
have a
ingredient.
What's in season in your area. So they use a
what can I make with bourbon? No available recipes. Wait a minute. Here we go. 32,000. Wait a minute. Bourbon, there's 185 bourbon recipes. Chocolate fudge with bourbon.
Hmm.
Trouble in Paradise, peach, ginger, and bourbon.
Now, what's great about this, too, is that the cooks rate them. But they also modify them. They make suggestions about this.
So
the example
these are the
I
user
used,
reviews, then.
Right. Yeah. So you can when you ever see ingredients you like, you can save it to your shopping list. You can get alerts on your shopping list when you're near a store that has those things. It
next
even
time
has
you're at the store, Mike, get a tablespoon of bourbon, would you?
I will do. Okay. Yeah, you can make. And it also has voice commands, so you can interact with the recipes by voice because you have like. You know, stuff all over your hands because you're cooking.
Yeah.
You can talk
what's
to your
next?
Phone
right.
to interact with the recipe, and it will tell you what's going on with the recipe. Lots of different categories, you know, like you saw.
This is going to be used in the Elgin home to very good end.
That's right. So this brings the recipe specifically from Bon Appetit, Self, Random House, and others. And
Gourmet, may it rest in peace.
And you can comment and sort of interact, so it's like a social network for people cooking, which is kind of a cool idea.
There are lots of recipes. I've been using Big Oven, which is a kind of recipe aggregator, has millions of recipes. But the problem is you don't know what the quality is going to be. These are all published recipes at least, right?
Well, and here's a little story from the early days of Epicurious. So we had the right to use all the recipes from Gourmet and Bon Appetit. How could you beat that?
That's a good start.
They were all just in print. So we had to get them retyped, and we hired I didn't know this at the time, but there was honest to God, ask Padre, there was a service with monks.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than making fruitcake, they were typists.
Or illustrating Bibles.
Right. Wasn't that the original?
The monks, they had a scriptoria, right?
Exactly.
Exactly. So the monks retyped all the recipes that created Epicurus.
This spicy upscale popcorn combines two international ingredients.
Since we're on foodie stuff, have you gone to, do you use Foodie, Mike?
No.
What's Foodie?
Foodie is from Glam, my friends at Glam, now known as Mode. And
is it a website?
It's an aggregation. It's a website aggregation. And it's
foodie.com.
It's just people saving recipes.
It's like the Pinterest of calories.
Exactly.
And it's amazing. Some.
It's amazing.
Oh, signing up.
Yeah, look at that.
Some nice photography.
Just want to start eating things.
See, this can't be good for a diet.
No.
No, it's not.
No, I should have a diet button.
Right.
It says, I'm on a diet. Only show me food. It looks disgusting.
It should tie into quantified self stuff, and it should, if you're already overweight, it should just not show you this stuff.
Right.
Give me a break.
Samoa cheesecake. This is a cheesecake that looks like a Girl Scout cookie.
Hasselback sweet potatoes with parmesan and sage.
Is it named after David Hasselback? This is from a site called gimmesomeoven.com. I like it.
Yeah.
Foodies are great. Don't you love foodies? FOODIE.com. This is nice, Jeff.
Isn't this?
I like it.
What this does is send the traffic. If you click on a recipe, you'll go to a page that's still foodie that mentions, you know, some of the ingredients and stuff, but you don't get the whole recipe there. You only get it when you go to the creator's site. So it's a way to send traffic to the creator's sites along the way, and Glam will be doing more of this in the future.
I am now a foodie member. I signed up. Look at
nice.
That. Do they have another companion site called Nudie? Because I would go there, too.
It's a great site. You can go there and not buy clothes. There's a commerce model that isn't really
working.
I am
not going to make this. White chocolate-covered Ritz crackers. Nope. Not going to make it. Not going to do it.
I'm sorry. Packaged food like Ritz crackers is not an ingredient.
It's not an ingredient. I see... I was talking to somebody who said, oh, you would love this restaurant. They had a dessert made of Nutella. And I said, you know, I don't go to restaurants where they take the dessert out of a jar. Yeah. Thank you. On the other hand, chocolate chip cookies in a jar. Maybe I do that. That's a gift.
We got that.
You got that?
I got that for Christmas,
actually. It's the whole thing, right? Everything you need to make
chocolate. Yeah, it's all the ingredients, yes. Yeah. And it looks all nifty in the jar. We haven't made it yet, but we need to make it.
That's so clever. It comes with everything you need. It's kind of like a blue apron for chocolate chip cookies.
Yeah.
Look at even did they put the measuring spoons?
I didn't get the measuring spoons.
That's fancy.
Cookie jar.
That's a little
I'm going to have to talk to whoever gave us that gift.
You're supposed to put measuring spoons.
It's okay. We have tons of measuring spoons.
Yeah, that's the last thing you need more of. All right, my tip. There's a genesis to this story. We had talked before about Google's App Inventor. This was a system that Google had created to make it very easy to write Android apps. Not sophisticated Android apps, but children and people like me, hobbyists, could learn how to write software and learn how to write it for Android phones and actually package their software up not only for their own phone but for sale on the Play Store. And it was a really great thing. Google gave it up. They gave it to MIT. MIT has released App Inventor 2, and I've been looking to write an app for a Nexus 7 tablet that would help me with a radio show. And I downloaded the new Google, integrated development engine and all this stuff. And it was just like, oh, please. It was way over my head. I said, I don't have time to learn all this stuff. So I downloaded this, and this is the coolest thing ever. And everybody's got to try this. It's free. If you go to appinventor.mit.edu, you create new projects. I'll show you. I have a few projects. They have pretty good tutorials. In fact, this is the first tutorial. I'll show you this one. It's called Talk to Me. Now, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to connect to your phone. Now, I don't know why my but here, if you can, I don't know if you can see my phone. So I'm going to connect to my AI companion. By you're going to have to follow me on this one. It's a little complicated. Now go to my screen. There you go. This QR code. I scanned the QR code into the phone. Now, it's given me a code. We're both on the same Wi-Fi. The app appears on the phone, and as you modify the app, it is instantly, no USB connection. This is the designer, so you design the UI here, and they've got a lot of tools. They've got buttons, checkboxes, layout tools. They've even got Lego Mindstorm tools, if you have Lego Mindstorm. Storage, social, sensors. You can use the accelerometer, the barcode, this clock, the location, all of the stuff on your phone. Then you go into blocks. Look at this. This is the programming interface. So I put on this screen a text box. These are all the commands I can use for the text box. A button and text to speech. Let's set this up. I'm going to write. Now, by the way, if you saw that message in there, just ignore that. I was showing the 12-year-old how to do this, and he decided to put profane messages in here. So that, but that's cool, right? What better way to get a kid into programming? So this, I know your son Kevin does a Tinker,
yep,
which is a similar kind of a, yep, system on iOS. So I have now written this software. It is on the phone instantly, and watch, I can do a couple of things. If I shake, let me turn up the volume here. If I shake the phone, I've told it to say something.
Stop shaking me. Stop shaking me.
But I can also enter some text. This is an actual Android app. This is some text. It took me about 3 seconds to write, honestly, and I can speak it.
This is some text.
But the point is, you now have an app, and as you modify the app on your screen, on the App Inventor, it will immediately go over to your phone through the Wi-Fi. You can prototype, turn it around very quickly. It's got a great programming interface. Show the screen again, if you would, Jason. I know, I'm shaking you on it. You should. It's got all of this stuff built in, logic, math, text, and they're all snappable. So, for instance, if you put something in here, if you drag it onto the interface, it'll show you puzzle pieces, and only things with that shape can go into there. It is spectacular. I was able to get the accelerometer sensor working in such a way that when the accelerometer starts shaking, call text to speech and then speak this method, this message. That's just a text message which snaps on there like a puzzle piece. Folks, if you've been interested in kind of programming, if you have an Android device and you'd like to learn a little bit more about it, if you want an easy way to create your own apps, or even, believe it or not, there's the ability to package these up, apps for the that you could sell or give away on the Play Store, you got to take a look. They've really made something special here. The MIT App Inventor 2, and I feel pretty good about this. I feel like I'm going to be able to write the very simple software I needed, mm-hmm, to be a timer for the radio show. I want it to flash red when I'm running out of time and green when I have some time left and count down so I can go to the bathroom and look, oh, I've got a minute left. I've needed this for some time. I wrote something in AppleScript ages ago, but I'll put this on the Nexus 7.
The problem isn't you're going to be in the bathroom and it's going to say, stop shaking me.
Stop shaking me. Stop shaking me.
You can change it. I can actually change this to "Stop shaking me, Mike." Look how fast it changes it.
Stop shaking me, Mike.
Great. Throw me under
the
bus.
Look at that. Ladies and gentlemen, we are done with This Week in Google. Mike Elgin, always great to have you. You catch
always
Mike
great to be on.
Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC for your daily dose of tech news. You're going to Barcelona.
Barcelona, yes. Looking forward to it, to cover Mobile World Congress.
That's early next month?
Yes, very early, fifth, yes.
I think. Yeah.
Second through fifth. Yeah.
So live reports.
That you and Jason, all you three, is Samsung going to redeem itself with the next phone?
I like the Note 4. I think the Note 4 is actually great. Oh, you mean in its keynote presentation?
The S6, yeah. Yes. I think they might. I'm rooting for the new Edge, with the Edge on both sides.
The Edge on both sides.
And make it more mainstream and make it kind of work better, like you pointed out all the flaws on it. But I'd love something like that, and bring the price down a little bit. But you know, it's going to be something curved, no matter what. I guarantee.
Mobile World Congress
curved.
Has become I forget CES now. I really think that the most interesting stuff's happening in Barcelona.
Jason, what do you think?
Barcelona. Jason. He wants to go. That's what he thinks. He wishes he was going.
Yeah, it's really a bummer that I can't be there. But
can't send all of you.
That's what Jason's
exactly. Not everybody's going. I'll be curious to see what they do. I mean, the invite clearly for the event clearly showed the contour of the Edge.
Right.
So I don't know if that means new Note Edge or the S6 now has Edge in it, and that's just the new design
really
of the S6.
Do you think they'll redeem themselves?
I think so. I think they're on the right track. I think they're changing. They're changing their approach.
The Note
4
is a great great device. Mm-hmm. I think the S5 was a little crufted up.
Yeah.
But the Note 4 is great. I don't think Samsung needs to redeem itself. It does in its presentations, if that's what you mean.
Yeah.
Here's orchestra. The invitation. What's next? I don't know.
I mean, everybody's kind of expecting a more like metallic body, metallic design, as
like
opposed to the plastic.
Fork. I think they're going to do a haptic fork.
Yeah, yes.
That's what I think.
It'll only work the Samsung Galaxy S6, nothing else.
So we will be covering a Mobile World Congress. Mike will be there. Now, because of the time difference, all the stuff that's happening is happening in the middle of the night,
right?
California time, but you're still going to do it.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
1 a.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 4 a.m. Eastern time.
Right.
Tune in, because that's 9 a.m. in Barcelona or 10 a.m.
We'll just be back from dinner.
Well, you don't have dinner in Spain until 11 p.m. or something.
Right. No. 11 p.m.? What are you? 2 a.m.? Come on. You eat early eater. What are you, 60 years old? thank you. That's when the early bird specials are
at
Denny's Barcelona. Thank you for joining us, everybody. Thank you to Jeff Jarvis from the City University of New York, buzzmachine.com, and Geeks Bearing Gifts.
Thank you for the plug.
Hold up the book. Imagining new futures.
And look at that. It's a geek bearing a gift.
There he is. That's a gift just for you.
Shake me harder. Shake me harder.
Oh, boy.
Please.
Shake me harder.
Thank you. You can do anything you want.
Thank
you for removing Mike from that.
Thanks for joining us. We do Twig every Wednesday afternoon, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern time, 2100 UTC. Please join us. We'd love to see you here. And if you can't be here, don't worry about it. We've always got on-demand versions of all of our shows at the website, twit.tv. In this case, twit.tv/twig. Also on YouTube, youtube.com/thisweekingGoogle, and wherever you find your podcast, including those great apps written by many talented third-party developers on iOS, Android, Windows Phone, Roku. We don't have a Chrome extension yet, but I guess you could just go to
Live.
No, we do. We do.
We do?
We
do.
Okay,
we have an extension?
Live.
It's a website. Yeah.
No, we have an extension.
That's the extension. Go to live.twit.tv.
I have the extension. It's really great.
Really?
Yeah.
Somebody wrote an extension?
It's called Floating Twit. Boom.
Boom. Booyah. Get Floating Twit and never miss another show. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Twig.